I'd like to start the talk tonight with a memory. When I was a teenager, one of my favorite things to do was to go out backpacking. So we'd go deep in the backcountry and carrying everything we needed on our backs, hiking out to remote lakes and mountains. And as part of this experience, we needed to hike from water source to water source to refill our water bottles. And sometimes this would be from a tiny creek or a large lake, a little spring. And we had these hand pumps, these plastic hand pumps with a tube on one end and tube on the other. And we'd put one end in the water body and we'd filter out the bacteria that way. And the filters were pretty good. But if the water we found was too murky or too filled with silt or too covered over with moss or other overgrowth, then the filters wouldn't really be able to function and we couldn't drink the water. So we needed our water to be somewhat clear in order to sustain us on this journey. So I remembered this recently when I was thinking about the mind. Our mind is a little like the water we would find on our backpacking trips. When the mind is clear, it can be life-giving. It can sustain and support us in becoming more free in our lives and supporting us to be more loving, more joyful, more wise. But if the mind is too agitated, if it's too murky or overgrown, if it's too covered over, then we're unable to see clearly. And the qualities of love and of wisdom are obscured by the silt of the mind, and we're really unable to move towards freedom. So the Buddha gave, he names five specific states of mind that create this lack of clarity. And these are called the five hindrances. And the hindrances are known for covering over and obscuring our wisdom. They contract the mind. So typically, if we're having a difficult time, chances are one of the hindrances is at work. And so this is what I'll be talking about tonight is the five hindrances. So if you're unfamiliar with the hindrances, I'll share the list with you right now. The first is sense desire, so that's the wanting mind. The second is ill will, often referred to as aversion. So these are two sides of the same coin, wanting and not wanting. The third is restlessness. This can manifest as mental and physical agitation, often high energy. The fourth is sleepiness, typically translated as sloth and torpor. And so those are two energetic states, high energy, restlessness, low energy, sleepiness. And then the fifth is doubt. So, for anyone who is a visual learner, I'll put those in the chat for you. There you go. So, you don't have to try to remember. So, the Buddha compared the mind to a bowl of water. So, in an unafflicted mind, the water's clear. But in a mind afflicted with the hindrances, the water's not clear. So, he actually compared each of the hindrances to being like a certain type of water with, something in it that obscures its clarity. So he says that the doubtful mind is like murky water. The sleepy mind is like water overgrown by moss. The restless mind is stirred up water. The aversive mind is boiling. I think we know that experience of being boiling with anger. And the desirous mind is like water filled with colorful dyes, distracted and enchanted by it. So in all of these cases, the mind isn't clear. We can't see clearly. Lucky for us, the Buddha offered a variety of approaches to working with the hindrances. So in this talk, what I'll do is I'll share a general singular practice that can be used for working with all five of the hindrances, kind of a one-size-fits-all practice. And then I'll go through each practice or each hindrance one by one to share some specific information about each, as well as some particular ways to practice with each of the hindrances. And something I find quite helpful to know is that almost anything I'm struggling with can really, in large part, be distilled to simply being a manifestation of one of the hindrances. So simple, just one of these five things. So if I can learn how to meet these hindrances skillfully, then I can be so much more free in daily life. So this is really useful, right? Really practical. So to begin, here's the one size fits all practice that you can do to meet any of the hindrances when they arise. And if this is the only thing you remember from the talk, it will serve you well. Only two steps. Step one, recognize what's present. This is simple mindfulness practice, right? So just recognize what's present. Identify what's happening. Oh, this is wanting. Or, oh, this is sleepiness. And it's really helpful to know the hindrance as a hindrance. That is, we're aware that it's present. We're so often transfixed by the storyline of what we want or what we hate that we don't even know that desire or aversion are fueling the whole show. So can we actually see what's fueling the storyline and name it? Oh, this is desire. Okay. And sometimes just the act of naming something can make it lose its power. It's as if there's something within us that's asking for attention to recognize it, to identify it. And to do that, to identify it, it gives it the attention it's been seeking. It can release. Dr. Dan Siegel coined the phrase, name it to tame it. So sometimes when we can just name something, it can release some of the power. So some time ago, I agreed to undergo a period of more intense meditation training in a style that I was somewhat unfamiliar with. And there was the circumstances were such that there was some pressure to really like learn this meditation technique. And as you can imagine, having pressure to learn a meditation technique is not a really great circumstance for learning a new meditation technique. As one could expect, I found myself worrying about whether I was any good at this technique and whether I could keep up with the training. So one day I was sitting, mulling over my sense of impending insufficiency, when something interesting occurred in the mind. So bubbling up from who knows where was this thought. And the thought said, this is just doubt. All that's happening right now is doubt. And knowing that doubt is just one of the hindrances, I know, okay, well, I don't need to take the hindrances personally. And with the recognition, this is just doubt, it was as though the magic spell was lifted. The naming of the doubt, just no, no, this is doubt. All this ruminating, just doubt. The naming of it released its power and the whole package fell away. And in that moment, I didn't let go of the doubt. That wasn't me who did that. It was the mind's inner wisdom that released the doubt. And that's part of what this training can do. So step one, recognize the hindrance. And often, simple recognition won't cause the hindrance to evaporate. So then we have the opportunity to practice the second step. So that's when we feel the hindrance. We feel what's happening in the body, specifically in the body. So we get to know the hindrance. That's really what the second step is all about, getting to know the hindrance. And so we can get curious about what's happening and investigate what's going on. So as I mentioned, often when we're entranced by a hindrance, there's typically an object we're fixated on. And this especially happens with desire and with ill will or aversion. We're fixated on wanting a new haircut, or we're feeling annoyed by our roommate for not taking out the trash. So we're preoccupied with the object. We're preoccupied with how am I going to get the haircut? or how am I going to convince my roommate to do this or that? So we're preoccupied by the haircut or the roommate. And instead of sticking with the preoccupation with the narrative, instead, in this way of working with the hindrances, we let go of obsessing about the object and instead turn our attention 180 degrees to look inward at the desire, at the aversion, the restlessness itself. And this begins to pull us out of our trance. This begins to pull us out of our daydream. Rather than trying to get rid of our hindrance, we turn and look at it. We turn and feel it. And so I want to say just a little bit more about how we do that. What's it actually like to explore, to get to know a hindrance? So feeling it in the body, just as we did in the meditation tonight, we might notice if there's tightness or contraction, coolness, tingling, pressure. Just noticing what's happening in the body with the hindrance. Often there'll be a contraction associated with it. Not always, that might be something that's present. You might feel the energy in the body. Maybe there's a high frequency racing energy or heavy drooping lethargy. And feel the hindrance in the mind. What's the emotional tone? How does it color the mind? Does it make you want to do something? Are there repeating thought patterns? Are the thoughts loud or quiet? So again, not getting caught in the narrative, but watching the mind, just observing how it's functioning. So this is how we can get to know our hindrance. So that's it. Those are the two steps. Recognize and feel. And it's through being with the felt experience of the suffering of a hindrance, through being in the body with the experience of anger or craving, that our system can register, oh, this is suffering. And it's through doing this that our system learns to naturally let go of the hindrance. So, you know, if we keep touching a hot stove, our mind eventually learns, don't put your hand there, it hurts. We don't need to convince ourselves or talk ourselves into not putting our hand on a hot stove. We just know that hurts, I'm not going to do that. So in the same way, we don't need to get rid of our hindrances, but it's through one, recognizing, and two, feeling the hindrance in the present that the mind learns, ouch, this hurts. Ouch, this is suffering. I'm not going to do this anymore. And then the mind can let go of the hindrance on its own, just the way that my mind released doubt. I didn't make the doubt release, but I've been with the suffering of doubt enough times. I've put my hand on that stove enough times that the inner wisdom knows we don't need to do that anymore. Doubt, oh, we know that one. No, thank you. So I'll now go through each of the hindrances individually to say a little bit more about each one, and then I'll share some of the antidotes for them. And I'll go a little more slowly through the first hindrance and the second, just so you can get the hang of the practice, and then I'll go a little more quickly through the latter ones. So an antidote, if you're unfamiliar, in modern parlance, an antidote is traditionally a medicine taken to counteract a particular poison. And this isn't any different. We apply an antidote to a hindrance to help counteract it. So typically, if a hindrance arises for you during daily life or in meditation, you can do the practice that I just shared, recognize and feel. However, when a person has become overwhelmed by a hindrance or can't deal with it and really isn't able to stay mindful with the hindrance anymore, and it's not softening, maybe you've tried being mindful for a while, it might be a good time to apply an antidote. So either you can't be mindful or you've been mindful for a really long time, and you might explore an antidote, and that can help restore the mind's natural balance. So let's start with the first hindrance, sense desire. So Other ways we might refer to this hindrance include craving, wanting to acquire things, longing, grasping. So sense desire is at work when we long for a cup of coffee, or when we seek to look more physically beautiful, or to see something that's visually appealing, going to a gallery or a show. Sense desire is active when the mind daydreams about romantic or sexual fantasies, or when it gets fixated on recreating a blissful meditation experience. So these are all different ways, a myriad different ways that sense desire can occur. And as you know, we have five senses. In Buddhism, we add a sixth, the mind. So we have hearing, seeing, touching, tasting, smelling, and thinking. Those are the six senses. So sense desire is craving for pleasant experience at any of these sense gates. It's the craving to see, hear, smell, touch, taste, think what is pleasant and agreeable. And often when we have free time, we like to fill it from start to finish with things that bring forth sense pleasure. And generally, what's at the heart of sense desire is a feeling that something could make this moment better, that this moment isn't quite sufficient, and that happiness resides in the next sense pleasure. And this is really common in US, the dominant US culture. You know, a happy life is one where we can string together enough pleasant moments. And a really happy life is where no unpleasant moments can sneak in there, right? So I do also want to note, though, that not all desires are a problem. For example, the desire to be free from suffering, or to be compassionate, or to want to be patient, those are pretty wholesome desires. You don't have to get rid of those. And then we have what I might call innocuous desires, the desire to go out for a walk or to put on a sweater. And what shifts an innocuous desire into a hindrance is when we're gripped by it, when we're preoccupied by it, when we're pushed around by it. And when it's really strong, it can really run the show. It's very persistent, convincing. And it's, for me, I can really tell that sense desire is active when it feels like sense desire is driving and I'm in the passenger seat and I'm getting taken for a ride. So at one point, the Dalai Lama visited an abbey in Germany where they made fruitcake and cheese. And the monks there took him on a lengthy tour of the abbey, viewing all different areas. And at the end of the day, in the evening, when the Dalai Lama had a chance to sit down and talk with the monks, he recounted the tour and he shared some of the different highlights. And he said that throughout the tour, the monks kept offering him samples of cheese, kept offering cheese and more cheese, but that all he really wanted the entire time was fruitcake. And with that, he threw his head back laughing and held his sense desire with total openness in a way that didn't have any distress or any disappointment. So if the Dalai Lama has sense desire, I think it's okay if we have some sense desire too. We don't have to be so hard on ourselves. But when sense desire arises, how can we meet it with equal wisdom? How can we meet it without being owned by it? So we can do the practice I shared. We can recognize it and we can feel it, right? And something I want to mention specifically about sense desire is that as you investigate it, you might find that sometimes it seems enjoyable. And this is interesting because we can get really excited about something we want, right? Ooh, this home improvement project's really exciting. When I think about it, I'm so thrilled. Or we get really thrilled by a new purchase and it has a sort of pleasant sparkle in our mind. However, under the surface, what we find as the mind gets more settled is that that state of craving, that sort of sparkle that we can present as pleasant, It reflects a sense of deeper insufficiency. There's some bit of not enoughness or lack in there. So the mind that's content is actually much more peaceful than the excited mind that craves the next sense pleasure. And of course, sense pleasure doesn't always register as pleasant, especially if there's something that keeps us from what we crave. If we're not able to get that thing, then there can be frustration and impatience and longing, all of the associated painful states. So if you're having a hard time being mindful of sense desire, you might try an antidote. So one of the antidotes for sense desire is impermanence or inconstancy. So it's remembering that whatever it is that we want will pass away in time. We all know this cognitively, but it can be hard to remember that at times when craving is present. So it can be helpful to reflect that even if I get what I want, it's going to pass away. Or even if I get what I want and it lasts for a very long time, my enchantment with it will probably pass away. If you're like me, you may have had the experience of buying something that you're so excited about, you just can't wait, and you're so happy to have it. And then a month later, you still own it, but it's pretty neutral. It kind of ceases to enchant the mind. So this act of remembering the impermanence of an object, the impermanence of our enchantment, can be useful. So beyond just a reflecting about impermanence, in deeper meditation, observing impermanence can allow this insight to register more deeply. So actually watching the arising and passing of things, to actually observe impermanence at work, the arising and passing of sensations in the body, of sounds, of emotions, of thoughts, this can more deeply mature our insight into impermanence. And when we understand at a deeper level how everything is falling away and changing, it's much harder to be fooled by sense desire. And when we can see desire itself arise, it can be really interesting to look for that. See if you can notice when sense desire itself arises. And if you can catch it as it's arising in the mind, it can be easier to disentangle from it. It's as though it hasn't quite sunk its teeth in yet. And for me, I think it can be really fun to watch craving, sense desire for food to arise. I'll notice maybe a little picture of ice cream floating across the screen. And when I see it arise and it hasn't been able to fully grip me yet, it's much easier to put it down. I just might go, no, oh, sense desire. We'll see it arise and pass away. So that's one of the antidotes for sense desire, reflecting on and observing impermanence. And now lastly, and this goes for every hindrance, don't miss recognizing when it's absent. So when the mind isn't afflicted by sense desire, allow yourself to feel the goodness of that. Allow yourself to register the felt experience of satisfaction and contentment. Because the more satisfaction you're present for in your life, the less likely it is that the mechanism of sense desire will kick in, right? So we can approach it from that angle too. Be present for contentment. And if you're content, why desire something, right? So, okay. Hindrance two, ill will or aversion. So this can manifest as anger, not liking, judgment, resentment, fear, guilt, boredom, grief. So lots of different ways this can manifest. For anyone who has been following the news, emotions like anger, fear, judgment, grief might sound somewhat familiar to you. Maybe that's somewhat close at hand these days. If so, recognizing these responses as aversion, oh, this is just the hindrance of aversion, and practicing with them using these tools may be helpful. So just as with sense desire, we can recognize, oh, this is aversion. We can let go of the fixation on the object, let go of the fixation on the news story, for example, and instead feel the inner experience, investigate the experience in the body, noticing how the hindrance covers the mind. The Zen teacher, Lian Shut, talks about this hindrance as the terrible twos, two spelled T-O-O. So we can know aversion is happening when the mind is saying, too messy, too cold, too many bugs, too itchy, too loud. So these are the terrible twos might indicate to you that aversion is at work in the mind. Lian goes on to say that if we have the terrible twos, this can very easily turn into the terrible yous, Y-O-U, as in we find ourselves judging you and you and you. Maybe he's too talkative, she's too eager, they're too aggressive, they're too moody. So watch out for T-O-O in the mind, or that sort of sense in the mind, because this can help you recognize when aversion is present. Remember, name it to tame it. So if the mind's unable to be mindful, or the mind's overwhelmed by aversion, we can apply an antidote. And the classic antidote for aversion is metta, or loving kindness practice. So the friendly mind of kindness obstructs aversion. The sense of anger or disliking actually can't arise in the heart of loving kindness. However, for me, when I'm angry and I practice metta, it's often too inaccessible to send kindness to somebody I might be angry at. But what I can do in those moments is I can send loving kindness to myself. So that's often what I suggest for people is if you're suffering with anger or frustration, try practicing metta for yourself if you're going to apply an antidote. I also want to note, I won't go into the full loving kindness practice here. There's lots of resources on that. But one common misconception with metta practice is that we actually need to feel loving when we're doing it. And the good news is that you actually don't, and the practice is still working, even if you don't feel radiant love within you. It's actually enough to just have the wish to be kind. Just planting the seed of, may I be loving, may I be kind. Even without the feeling, plants the seed in the mind, and that seed will grow on its own time. We can't control when that will fruit with the actual feeling of loving kindness, but just to plant the seed is enough. And then lastly, notice when the mind is free from aversion. Enjoy it when the mind is kind, when it's at ease, and let those moments register. So that's the first two. We have wanting and not wanting, in short. And then the next, the third, we're going into the two energetic states, one characterized by low energy, one characterized by high energy. We'll start with sloth and torpor. So sloth and torpor is often referred to as drowsiness, fatigue, sleepiness, dullness. Sloth typically refers to mental sleepiness and torpor to a physical tiredness. I don't personally use either of those words in my common vocabulary, but they are the common ways that this hindrance is referred to. And so there's different ways that this can manifest in practice. It can come about from genuinely feeling tired, genuinely underslept or depleted. But it can also come about as one acclimates to meditation and to a quiet mind where we're not entertaining ourselves with our inner fantasies anymore. So when those fantasies start to slow down and we're just paying attention to the breath, not so exciting anymore, and we might fall asleep. We might get a little sluggish or sleepy from that. And then lastly, another way that that sloth and torpor can arise and experience is that it can come about as a defense mechanism. And sometimes this will happen for people when there's something difficult coming up for them, that the mind actually will go to sleepiness so then it doesn't have to feel what's coming up. So that there's a kind of a shutting down so that we don't have to feel something. In my early meditation retreats, I had a lot of sleepiness, a lot of this kind of head jerking, bucking bronco sort of thing during meditation. And this was really, really unpleasant for me. And there was a lot of fighting, kind of like a gritting my teeth and squinting, trying to stay awake. And what I learned over time was that much of the suffering with sleepiness was my resistance to it. My sense that the sleepiness shouldn't be there and that I needed to fight my way through the sleepiness in order to have a good meditation. So for me, it was the aversion that was making the experience a suffering state. But sleepiness is karmically neutral. It's not bad. So what was happening for me was a multiple hindrance attack. I actually had sleepiness in combination followed by aversion. I had sleepiness followed by aversion. So there's two hindrances at work there. But sleepiness becomes a lot easier to work with if we're not adding on that extra hindrance of aversion. So the best way to practice with sleepiness, or maybe I should say a way to reduce suffering when practicing sleepiness, is not to resist it, to befriend it. So we can still bring mindfulness into whatever sleepy state is there, whatever tranquil state is present. We can continue to be with the breath, even if it's from a tired place. And it's fine if there's times in meditation that aren't crystal clear. And maybe if there's a period of meditation that's sleepy, you can just be sleepy Buddha. Nothing to fight. And again, the basic instruction applies. We can recognize the sleepiness, and then we practice feeling it. And there's something that can be particularly helpful in the practice of getting to know the sleepiness and feeling and investigating the sleepiness, and that's to turn up the volume a bit on our curiosity. Turn up the volume a bit on the investigation factor as when we get to know sleepiness. And that what that does is it increases the energy, and energy happens to be the antidote to sleepiness. So just getting a little bit more curious has actually been revolutionary in my practice with this hindrance. And it's because sleepiness has actually become interesting to me. So I've started exploring. I remember one retreat in particular where there was a lot of sleepiness. I'd look inside and I'd try to find the sleepiest spot in my entire body. And I found that often there was actually an epicenter to my sleepiness, like a certain area in the body that if the attention went there, I'd fall asleep immediately. But if I kind of hovered close to it and checked it out, I was like, wow, look at that. And it was often behind one of my eyes, not both, but be one or the other. That would be the epicenter of sleepiness for me. So that's one thing that can be explored. Or I might look to see if I could notice the moment the mind fell asleep, the very moment the mind shifted into a sleep state, like that first flash of a sleep state. Or noticing if I fell asleep on an in-breath or an out-breath. Or if I'm counting breaths from 1 to 10, when did I lose track? Well, it seems like I keep falling asleep kind of somewhere, but after 6. Okay, then restart my breaths. Oh, it seems like I fell asleep somewhere around 6 again. So these are just different tools and ways that we can get curious and interested in sleepiness. And rather than fighting it, we can just kind of ride the wave of it, allow the mind to be a little softer and more tranquil sometimes, and just ride through it. So as I mentioned, the antidote is energy. So we can bring investigation, we can turn up the investigation, which brings energy. And what to do something, maybe a slightly more extreme intervention is actually to to open the eyes, let in more light, sit up straighter, take a few deep breaths, and maybe that's not so so extreme an intervention, but going on a brisk walk might be to actually get up and walk around, splash water on your face. And if you need to, even the Buddha said this, at the end of a long list of interventions for sleepiness, go take a nap. So that's always possible. And one thing that I've noticed is cooling down the body. So if my body is too warm, if I'm in a comfy sweater or blanket in the meditation hall, I'm much more likely to fall asleep. But if I sit in a tank top or a short sleeve shirt in a cool meditation hall, that usually keeps me awake. And then lastly, I want to say something about defensive sleep. If it seems like the mind keeps shutting down because there might be something else happening, you might not know exactly what it is, might ask yourself, just drop in the question, is there something underneath this? Is there something underneath this? So if sloth and torpor is your hindrance of choice for a while, and it's occurring a lot in your practice, you could try dropping in that question. Okay, the fourth hindrance is restlessness. So with restlessness, there can be an overabundance of energy. It's sometimes referred to as worry and flurry. Worry and flurry. And there's two types of restlessness, mental and physical. So mental restlessness can manifest as an agitated, anxious, worrying mind. And a restless body often can't sit still in meditation. It's fidgeting, shifting, itching. So you may have experienced physical restlessness while sitting before. Or off the cushion, that physical restlessness might come forth as a need to keep doing things, kind of this momentum, getting home from work, racing around, can't drop the momentum. So with restlessness, it can be helpful to remember that this is a natural part of being human. The Dharma teacher and author Mark Lesser reminds us that we are the descendants of the nervous apes. All the chilled out apes got eaten. So it's the nervous apes that lived on to make baby apes. So those are our ancestors. So don't be too hard on yourself if you find yourself anxious. Anxiety is deeply conditioned in us. So the antidote is calm or tranquility. So if you feel restless, one thing that can bring forth calm is connecting with your meditation anchor. As mentioned in our meditation earlier, maybe that's the breath or the soundscape or a global sense of the body sitting. If you take some time, maybe sit down, hang out with the anchor for a while, just make sure to do so in a gentle way, in a way that invites the mind to rest. What we're doing here is allowing the mind to gravitate around something simple. And this simplicity can be a refuge for the mind that is racing around and tangled up in complex anxiety-producing storylines. If, however, focusing on the anchor of meditation leads to a tightening or an increase in energy, you can try giving the mind a wider posture, opening the attention to sounds in a wide way to bring in calm. Another way to connect with calm is to notice if there's already calm present around you or in you in any way. Sometimes I'll have mental restlessness, but when I stop and look inward, I might notice that there's a part of the body that actually feels calm. So maybe the mind was racing, but actually the shoulders are a little relaxed, or there's some area in the body that is without tension. So I might allow the mind to remember calmness from that part of the body. Or sometimes the mind and the body are restless, in which case we can tune into any calm that may be around us. So if we're in a meditation hall or we're in nature, I might open my eyes and see the space around me, and I might lean on the support of the calmness around me to help soothe myself. Or there might be a person that inspires calm in us. We might borrow or lean on their tranquility. And at some point, when the restlessness subsides, recognize the absence of restlessness. Notice what it's like having a calm mind or body, a relaxed, tranquil mind or body, and really get to know this experience. Let yourself be restored and nourished by it. Because again, the more your body registers, oh, this is peaceful, this feels good, the more the system learns, oh, this is where we want to hang out. Getting restless actually doesn't feel very good. We want to do this more often. So let yourself be fed by that. Really be mindful of that state. Because when you give more energy to something, more attention to something, you feed it. So that's what you want to feed, right? So the fifth hindrance is doubt. And doubt can manifest as doubt in the Buddha's teachings. Like, does this really work? Maybe I chose the wrong practice. I probably should have gone for Hinduism. Or it could be doubt in your teachers, doubt in yourself, in your own capacity or ability. Philip Moffitt calls doubt the mother of all the hindrances because it stops you before you get started. Oh, I can't do that. I shouldn't even bother. On the night leading up to the Buddha's enlightenment, the demon Mara visited the Buddha to prevent him from awakening. So Mara distracted the Buddha with his armies, and he tempted the Buddha with beautiful women, tried all different things to pull the Buddha off his seat. And Mara's final ammunition, he says to the Buddha, "Who do you think you are that you could be enlightened?" So Mara's final ammunition was to evoke doubt. Who do you think you are? And with that, the Buddha touched the earth and said, "With the earth as my witness, I have a right to be here." And he was freed. So becoming free from doubt is a powerful thing. And as I shared in my story earlier of self-doubt, it can be a very powerful visitor. When doubt arises, the insight teacher, Greg Scharf, he says he feels like he's part of the "I'm not very good at this club." And you might be able to relate. So something that can help with this is remembering that there's no need to evaluate or judge your progress in meditation. That is extra. You can put that aside. If we go to a guitar lesson for the first time, we don't expect to be a Grammy-winning musician the next day, right? But for some reason, when we sit down to meditate, sometimes we can expect that the mind is perfectly calm and without distraction. So instead, can we be patient with ourselves? The classic antidote to doubt is faith. Another word for faith is trust or confidence. So can we trust that whatever arising in our practice is arising right on time? Can we trust the Dharma? Can we trust the practice? Can we have confidence in it? So if you struggle with doubt, build a daily faith practice. Reflect on why you're practicing. It can be really helpful to reflect on moments in your life when the practice was beneficial for you. That turns up the volume on faith. And you can also borrow faith from your teachers or people that inspire you. People that you see the practice working in them. So that can help you to also have confidence in the practice. I saw a sign a while ago that said, "Proceed as though success were inevitable." I don't think humans do that very often. Can we trust that if we just show up with mindfulness and curiosity, that the practice is reliable? We can have confidence in it. We can proceed as though success were inevitable. So those are the five hindrances. And our task is simply to recognize and feel them, get to know them. And then don't miss the moments when you're free of hindrance. Don't miss the moments when the mind is free of the hindrance that was gripping it. So I'll review the common antidotes for you. So sense desire, reflecting on and observing impermanence, aversion or ill will, so metta, loving kindness, sloth and torpor, the antidote is energy, restlessness, the antidote is calm or tranquility, and for doubt, it's faith or confidence. So I want to say a little bit about our attitude towards hindrances. And this is one of the most important things with this practice. As we recognize and feel the hindrances, it's important to notice how we're relating to them. Often we recognize and feel the hindrances, but meanwhile we're judging ourselves or resisting the experience or trying to get rid of it when the hindrance arises. So let's loop back for a moment to the second hindrance of aversion. And I think that aversion holds a special place amongst the hindrances, so much so that I have a special name for it. I call it the tag-along hindrance. And this is because, typically, if any other hindrances are present, aversion will often tag along like a shadow. Because the hindrances themselves are often unpleasant, in addition to the primary hindrance, for me, I shared in the story of my sleepiness, often aversion will follow right behind. And we might notice that because we'll have a hindrance, primary hindrance, restlessness, sleepiness, desire, etc. And then there might be an attitude like, oh no, this shouldn't be happening. I was having such a nice meditation, or ugh, this sleepiness is ruining things, or my mind is so restless, there's too much thinking, I should know better. Any sorts of feelings like that, thoughts like that, you might check to see if aversion is tagging along. And often, you know, maybe we notice the initial hindrance, and then we're able to see that we're relating to it with aversion also. When we can see that the aversion is present, then we can begin to reorient and learn how to relate to both hindrances with more patience and more kindness. So it's all about our attitude to the hindrances. And please remember that it doesn't say anything about your worth as a person or as a meditator that you're visited by the hindrances. Remember, the Buddha was visited up through his night of enlightenment by the hindrances. So when they arise, if we can just meet them without resistance or aversion, we have the opportunity to transform them. And if there is resistance or aversion, can we then meet that with kindness and patience? If you notice aversion, you don't have to say, oh God, now I'm being aversive again, not that, because then we're just meeting aversion with more aversion, right? So wherever we find ourselves, at whatever spot, maybe it's the fifth point in our layer cake of reversion for aversion, aversion for more aversion, but wherever we catch ourselves, oh, we wake up in the present moment and we can just meet whatever's there with a clear, non-judgmental awareness. Oh, aversion is like this. Okay, there's a lot of aversion. No big deal. We can also think of the hindrances as a valuable messenger. We can think of them as valuable messengers that have come to teach us. So can we respect our hindrances as teachers, actually teaching us how to love our life? And our role is just to meet them, not as a diversion from the path, but as the path itself. The hindrance is actually the next stepping stone on the path, not a diversion, but the path itself. So when we can meet a hindrance with recognition, curiosity, investigation, we're simultaneously cultivating a wholesome state. So this isn't something going wrong. When you can be present with a hindrance, there's so many wholesome qualities that are being cultivated. So the seeing of a hindrance can bring joy and delight. Working with the hindrance is cultivating these beautiful qualities. So they can go hand in hand. Hindrances can actually be the medium by which we wake up. So when you have a hindrance visiting you, you can say, excellent, right on time. Nothing to fear, nothing to resist. So in a way, learning to be with the hindrances without rejection is an act of radical inclusion. It's making ourselves whole, nothing left out, such that there's nothing we're rejecting, nothing excluded. So I'd like to close with a poem by a female Japanese poet from the 10th century. Her name is Izumi Shikibu. It goes like this. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. I'll read it again. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. So let's sit together for just a moment. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. Thank you for your kind attention. So we'll now have a few minutes for questions or comments. So if you feel like sharing anything, you can raise your physical hand or raise your Zoom hand, and I will call on you. Or you can type it in the chat. And I actually see that there's a question in the chat about I would like to access this later. Will it be posted somewhere? Dharma Seed? Thank you. I believe this will be posted on the website for the Insight Meditation Community of Berkeley. I just had that up. I can double check that for you. Yeah, if you go to the Insight Meditation Community of Berkeley website, there's a link at the top that says Talks. You can click Dharma Talks, and they are posted there. And I'm not sure if that goes straight to Dharma Seed or what, but that's one way to access it. Any other questions or comments, reflections? Nathan.
Thank you so much for sharing this. This is a wonderful talk. Something that helped me or has been on my mind for the last couple of weeks is that when I'm experiencing anxiety, when I'm experiencing a difficult moment, I try to remind myself that anxiety is a warning sign. It's a signpost on my path that I can make a choice to take the easy path, which is just habituated, you know, response, or I can take a different path, which doesn't abandon myself. It doesn't compromise who I am on it, the honest part of me. So it's been a practice to have the mindfulness to be aware in that moment, and also to have the strength to choose the more the path I want to cultivate. But it's just been something that's helped me. So thank you.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you, Nathan. And when you do that, when you choose the different path, is that the path of actually meeting the anxiety itself and feeling it?
Yeah.
Or is it something else for you?
It's about getting in touch with how I truly want to respond in the moment. Hmm. Oftentimes it's in conversations with people whom I find difficult, and as opposed to kind of avoiding a potentially like contentious conversation, I'm trying to approach it with as much kindness, but as also as much honesty for myself as I can.
Well, that's a really great example of the way that working with a hindrance, working with a difficult emotion, part of that is checking out what our motivations are, what our intentions are, and how we want to act based on it. And so to actually choose a course of action that isn't based in anxiety and fear and doing what that habit pattern asks of you or demands of you, but actually to do something wiser, more upright, more mature response. And that's such a wonderful thing to do, because that further trains the system that it's actually okay to do that. You're not going to, the fear response, it's very old in us. You know, it's the response we had to saber-toothed tigers, and to actually do the thing that may seem scary, but that's the more upright thing. Over time, the system learns, oh, you know, this, I'm not going to get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger if I do this. This is actually, it's okay to do this. So that's such a wonderful practice. Thank you for sharing that. Any other reflections or questions? Rick.
Yes, I wanted to thank you very much for the teaching. It's very concise and the practical explanations and suggestions. I find it very helpful and really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thanks, Rick. I'm really glad that it was a helpful talk for you.
Very much so. I learned a lot. Problem is retaining it.
Yeah, I find that to be the problem also. We can learn it, but remembering is the trick. It takes lots of practice, right?
Have to learn it over and over again.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I found that it's taken listening to many, many, many talks on the hindrances to really start to be able to notice that a hindrance is present, actually recognize, oh, this is a hindrance right now. So hopefully you'll be a little faster than I am.
I found it very concise and clear, and very, I appreciate practical illustrations and suggestions. Mm-hmm. Very helpful.
Well, thank you for thank being you. Here. Thanks, Rick. Julia.
So, regarding ice cream, does that mean you never eat, or one never eats ice cream, because it's definitely only, we don't need it?
Such a great question. Fortunately, The Buddhist path doesn't mean you need to cut out everything pleasant from your life. So the source of suffering isn't the ice cream, it's the craving for the ice cream. So we can still enjoy ice cream, and we can, we can still enjoy ice cream, but it's when there's the craving and the grasping and the obsessive thoughts about it. And I know I'm going to have an ice cream after work, and I'm having this last conversation at work, and I'm hoping it ends soon so I can get my ice cream. And when is this person going to stop talking? And what if the ice cream store is closed? Or what if they miss the price? The mind can really obsess about what it wants. And there can be all sorts of distress if it doesn't get what it wants. So that's where the suffering is in the craving and the attachment to the ice cream. But if you actually have an ice cream, don't need to suffer about it, just enjoy it. And that's something that's so wonderful about the mindfulness practice, is that it can help us diminish and reduce suffering states. And it also helps grow and amplify wholesome states. So it can grow our appreciation for the ice cream. We can actually really be there with the flavors of the ice cream, and that we've trained in being present. And so we don't spend our whole time eating the ice cream thinking about what we're going to make for dinner or that weird conversation at work. We can actually just be with the ice cream. And of course, as I said in the talk, the more present we are for satisfaction, the less we're likely to crave, the less we're likely to engage in sense desire. So you just really be present and satisfied with that ice cream, and maybe there'll be less craving in the future.
Thank you.
You bet. Okay. Well, it looks like we should wrap it up for the evening. It's about 9 o'clock. I just got a message from someone saying that they joined a little late tonight. I will put the Dhamma link in the chat for you. For everyone else, thank you so much for being here. It was such a pleasure getting to practice with you, and I hope that we meet again. Take care, everyone.
Thank you.